copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
20-minute stab at this, if you'll bear with me, to see, well, what do we do? You know, the men of Issachar, if you remember in the Old Testament, they got behind David strategically with two big things. They understood the times and they knew what to do. So we've tried to understand the times just a little, a few scratches. But now the question, well, what can we do? And I've got two suggestions. And we're calling this reimagining the biblical vision amongst our own people. Okay, what must we do? And these are the two, a better critique and a better story. Those are my two headings. So what do I mean by a better critique? As I said earlier, often our critique of the sexual revolution has appeared defensive and protective of our own privileges. And we've failed to communicate to the outside world and by default to our own young people that this is about human flourishing. This is about the flourishing of everybody. And you know, Martin Luther King, let's do another Luther, Martin Luther King, his genius was that he advocated for black civil rights, not because he said these were good for blacks. He said that isn't what this is about. Our people, this is good for our people. We're advocating this because it's good for everybody. It's good for whites as well as blacks. That has to be the dynamic behind our recovery of our vision. We believe that the gospel is good, and it's good for human flourishing because God is good and his ways are good. And I have to say, I think in this area, some of us need to really stop and ask ourselves whether we really do have that conviction anymore, that the biblical vision for sex, human flourishing, is good. They've really got that conviction. So, having made that point, what might a better critique look like? Well, I'm just going to sketch this out, but it starts by acknowledging where we failed. What it does is it listens to the sexual revolution and to what it said. And where the sexual revolution challenged our shame culture and our hypocrisy and our judgmentalism, friends, let's take it on the chin. Let's see it as a blessing. Let's see it as a challenge that we should have heard at the time. Where it's saying to us, it's no good closeting all of this because God wants, you know, if God's there, he is a God of truth. Surely you can talk about it. You know, let's take it on the chin that much of our culture has been its own form of Gnosticism, the denial of the body. And take that on the chin, and I think if we can do that, if we can achieve that sense of common ground with the sexual revolution, then we're in a better position to critique it. And what I'd want to argue that we need to do is to critique the sexual revolution on its terms, not ours. Make our first critique on its terms. Critique it in terms of what it promised. Not what we want. That's where our critique should begin. And so what does it promise? It promised sexual revolution. It promised liberation. Now what did it deliver? Calmly, dispassionately, we point to ample data. I mean, for example, the statistician David Spiegelhalter in England just published a book called Sex by Numbers. And in it he shows compelling evidence that over the past 3 decades, 30 years, sex as a recreational activity has been declining. And this is a wonderful sort of irony that a movement that promised freedom and liberation, actually that promised more sex, has delivered less sex. And that is a fact. And there are a number of tracking surveys you can show how satisfaction with sex life isn't getting better, it's declining. We need to just gently point that out. But more important than that, we need, as evangelical Christians, to recover a vision for our children. Because you see, The sexual revolution promised freedom and equality. What it has done is it's heaped structural injustices and inequalities on the most vulnerable of all, kids, our children. Friends, divorce is bad news for kids. Morally, relationally, emotionally, materially, educationally. You know, we can critique individual studies, but in the round, divorce is bad news for kids. And, you know, well, we hear John Schrader, let's miss him out now, but these are the divorce rates which you can see rocketed through the 60s and 70s. They then plateaued off, but it's still the case that in the UK, 46% of marriages will end in divorce. And I repeat, divorce is bad news for kids, because most of these kids will grow up in fatherless homes, and I'll come back to that in a moment. But you notice here, these are actual marriages, and you can see how marriage is in decline. Fewer people got married in the UK in 2008 than at any previous time in records. Cohabitation is the new norm. And what I want to say, friends, is that cohabitation is even worse news for kids, because the instability of those relationships delivers the same outcomes as divorce, but the risks are even higher. Now, what do I mean? These are data from the Marriage Foundation, a wonderful foundation in the UK, started by a judge. And these show that independent of mother's age and education, those couples who get married, who were cohabiting, those cohabiting couples who get married and then have a child, have a 25% chance of splitting up. That's pretty bad. But those couples who have a child, who cohabit, have a child, and then get married, have a greater than 50% chance of splitting up. Those couples who never get married, cohabit, have a 2/3 chance of splitting up. Now, friends, Robert Putnam, the left-leaning social economist in the States, just produced a book that's made a big impact in the States. He has the ear of the Obama administration. It's called Our Kids. And he's saying, yes, there are things governments can do, but there's a generation, an underclass of children, kids, that have been created by the breakdown of communities and families. And what these kind of data show us is that it's torn relationships. And for the children of these torn relationships, most will go into homes that are fatherless. Now, single mothers do great jobs. Some kids are better off with a single mum than with a feckless, cruel father. That's a given, okay? But it is the case that kids do best in the round, on the whole, when a mum and dad are in the home. Because there's ample evidence that kids flourish when fathers are in the home. This is a simple association between social deprivation and the rates of fatherless. And these are the lowest social classes. These are the areas with the highest social deprivation, and these are the lowest areas of social deprivation. These are the rates of fatherless. You can see that in the areas of highest deprivation, 30%, one in three homes, have no father in them. Now, what we know about these homes isn't simply the well-known association between poverty and fatherlessness, but that fathers who are absent from the home of their children invest much less in the psychological, emotional, material welfare of their kids. So they visit their kids less. You see, when fathers and children live separately, 27% of those kids will never see their dad, get no visits. Another 20% will only see him several times a year. That's a half of those kids will only see a man several times a year, a father figure. Frequency of calls and emails, a third will get an email less than once a month. one to four times a year, half of these kids. Friends, we have to recover God's heart for kids. You know, one of the great things about the early Christians that separated from, that distinguished them from Roman culture, was their love of kids, because of course they followed a Savior who had gathered kids, who was natural with kids, who loved kids. In fact, who put a kid amongst his disciples and said, "These are the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." And we as Christians are doing wonderful social work among kids at all kinds of levels. But one of the greatest things we can do is advocate for marriage, because marriage binds men into the responsibilities they have for the children they help to bring into the world. That is the genius of marriage. It binds men into their responsibilities for the children they bring into the world. And that's something we should be proud about, that we have this gift to human flourishing, a covenant that binds men in this way for the welfare of kids, for a generation of kids. Now, of course, you may want to come back and say, "Hang on a minute, is this chicken or egg?" And I'll wait for somebody to ask that. Is it people who are naturally faithful get married, or does marriage make people more faithful? That's an interesting question, and I'll come back to it. But in the round, a mum and dad in the home is good for kids, and in the round, marriage cements those kind of relationships. And we as Christians should be proud, thrilled that we have good news for the world, for human flourishing, and recover that sense of vision. So this is what I mean by a better critique. We're looking at the sexual revolution in terms of what it promised. Of course, we could go on. It promised authenticity. It promised children growing up out of shame. This is a culture that has pornographied childhood. If we want to critique this culture, we have lots to say, friends. That doesn't sound negative, it sounds good and wholesome, and it's inspiring. So a better critique, and then what I'd argue is we need a better story. And I'll tell you what, one of the things that really fascinates me is if I said to almost any of you, "What's the narrative of the sexual revolution?" You'd come up with something pretty quickly along the lines of, well, it's about people who were previously at the margins, who were seen as being nothing, out at the edge, being included, brought in, equal, made the same as others, made to feel that they count as well. It's about the throwing off of hypocrisy. You see, I've got the narrative. Now, if I say to you, "What's the Christian narrative? Give me the Christian vision for human flourishing in the area of sex, sexuality." I ask people this, and we're sort of stumped. We're stumped for the story, because it's not dancing in our imaginations anymore. We stop telling it. So what does it look like? Well, I haven't got a quick and easy answer to this, but I've got to get you thinking. But it's a story that has to have a telos that's about flourishing under God. Of course, the ultimate telos is the glory of God. And the glory of God is a man fully alive and a woman, but it is still the glory of God to which our human lives move and in which they have their being. But the glory of God is that we flourish as we serve his glory. "Seek first the kingdom of God, all these things shall be yours as well." That's the wonderful promise of the gospel. So it's a story which recovers its telos, its ending, in the glory of God and the goodness of God. It's a story which has a theme of rescue about it as well. Going back to Alan's point about the oppressed, the people who stood up for kids again, who stood up for marriage, young people maybe with the courage and guts to swim against the flow of our culture. It's a story that has heroes as well, potentially. It's a story which rescues us from individuality and says, "Hang on a minute, there may well be, and in fact, I believe there are some values that are so sacred that we really do mess with them to our cost. That it really is no good serving the needs of a subset of bees when we're destroying the whole hive. And we're proud that in our church we have some of those subset of bees who said, we are going to forego our rights and our immediate needs for sexual pleasure or sexual expression because we want to serve the whole hive. I have a wonderful pastor, one of our associate pastors, same-sex attracted. You can Google him on livingout.com. Proud to have him as my pastor because he's someone who says, my vision is that I serve the good of the whole hive by holding myself true to the vision that we flourish when we express our sexuality in the covenant of marriage. But then finally, it needs to be, and I'm just going to move on because time's gone, it's got to have imagination, this story, once again. It really does need to contain strands of heroes and villains once again. It needs to be capable of firing the imagination of our people. But, you know, open our Bibles. There you have the most extraordinary narrative of God wooing his people, of the God of the Old Testament speaking in the most embarrassing language, sexual language, about his love for his people and how his love is bound in covenant to them. And then we have the transfiguration of that vision in the New Testament as we see it painted as the sexual intimacy between a man and a woman is a picture of the love between Christ and his church. The story that God has etched into our most intimate fleshly life, the picture of redemption, Christ wooing, loving the church. And so our churches become, in our imagination, communities in which we have married couples who show that story as well as tell it. We don't just tell it, we live it and show it to others in our faithfulness to one another. And so when a man binds himself to a woman and he says, I'll bind to you for life, what he's saying is that God's like that. When he loves you, his most intimate, passionate love is a faithful, binding love. Look, it's etched into the lives of all the married couples in our church. But this is a community in which single people are included in those families, if it's really a thinking, creative community and find place of love. But those single people themselves, in their chastity, signal something as well. Because when they hold themselves chaste until and if they will be married in this way, they too deploy their sexuality in their chasteness in a way which preaches the gospel. Why? Because they say, no, I'm not having a one-night stand. I'm not going to be with you unless I know that it's in covenant. Because you see, God's like that. And in my singleness, in my chasteness, I'm pointing to the fact that he doesn't do one-night stands. He doesn't get tired. He's not here today, gone tomorrow. It's all about faithfulness, covenant. Can our pastors, you know, begin to tell that story again? Can we begin to live it in our fellowship? Friends, it's a huge task. But I'm just simply encouraged. We have been here before. You know, 2,000 years ago, a few men and women were so inspired by the truth of the resurrection of Jesus Christ that they went out and they lived lives. And they lived lives, and people looked at those lives in the way they treated women, children, slaves, each other, the way they built their homes. And pagans looked in on those lives, and if you hadn't read Rodney Stark's description of this, the rise of Christianity, the pagans looked in on those lives, were so attractive that by the 4th century AD, an empire was on the verge of faith. So we have been here before. We can do it again. And what I suggest, friends, is this is a story that needs to be told all over again. And that's the call of God to us here right now. But I'd love to hear some of your thoughts on how we stimulate and fire our imaginations or push back or insights. I think the first point just pick up on is Alan saying that our culture has all the levers for firing the imagination. You know, as I said earlier, they have the cultural narrative more generally at the level of plausibility structures. If any of you are fans of the sociologist Peter Berger, you know the plausibility structures are not detailed academic arguments. They are at an everyday knowledge level of information, truths that create and shape a culture. In other words, it's when you say something, your friend says, "Of course, everybody knows that." It wants everybody knows something, and it's going with time. These are the plausibility structures that sustain ways of life, and they are partly imaginative, they are partly cognitive, but they are built often by media elites who have all of the levers for firing our imagination. So they've got the rom-coms, as I said, and the sitcoms. Attractive people. How many people watch Modern Family here, you see? The extraordinary thing, I find it extraordinary how many Christians watch that program. I find it too painful. But how many people watch that? We don't mention any of this stuff in our church. You know, we barely touch on it, this great culture of silence, pained silence in our churches around these issues. Your members of your congregation are going home, certainly in England and the States, possibly other areas, and watching Modern Family, which really does deconstruct the notion of family and norms and gender and so on. So we've got a big challenge here, because there are heroes and villains out there, and you're the villains and other people are the heroes. So we need a narrative. That's why I think the imaginative strand here is so important. Yes, sorry, for the microphone. And I think you're making the point that could we recover this picture of sex as being, actually it is pointing to something. Rehabilitate, recover that. Again, in our churches, yeah. It's a big time. We've got to start talking about sex. And I'm an old guy, folks. I can manage it. So maybe maybe some of you younger guys could have a go. Yeah, that's what a great question. The question is, what about cohabiting and sex before marriage, which are so prevalent in our Christian communities? Which country, please?
Norway.
That may not be, you know, quite the same across all of the countries here, but all I would say was you may be surprised, whatever country you're in, about premarital sex. A friend of mine years ago who was a general practitioner said it's very funny because we have the most stringent standards of no sex before marriage in our church. But he said, I see everybody, you know, all the younger people who come for the prescriptions of the pill, it does not add up. It does not add up. He said, there's something very odd going on. And I think part of our difficulty is that we don't have the tools, the intellectual tools, for engaging, say, with the most recent iteration of the sexual revolution, which is only the most recent one, perhaps the most challenging, gay marriage and queer theory. We don't have the tools to begin because we sold out to this revolution decades ago as divorce became much easier, cohabitation began to happen, but certainly sex before marriage in a much covert way. And we need to recover the whole vision. That's why, you see, I haven't talked really, have I, about same-sex attraction. I've touched on it once or twice. And people often say, will you come and talk about same-sex attraction? I really want to talk about the sexual revolution, because this is about all our hearts. This is about recovering a vision that affects all of us, all our churches. So, you know, I think that's a great point. It begins with our, I think, really recovering our conviction that this is good news. And for some of us, that is a bit of work we've got to do with the Lord, whether we think it's good news. And what I've tried to do is paint some of the arguments we can use. But at the end of the day, is he good? And that's what it's about. Is he good? What I suggest we have to do is we have to cultivate something that's quite difficult, the art of holding dissonance inside. That what I mean by that is dissonance between what we believe and how we behave toward people. That is very difficult for us to do as human beings, you know. I was talking to a guy in another country. He said my daughter, and he was a pastor, godly man, traditional in his beliefs. He said, my daughter came out gay. She's a lesbian, and she's married another woman, and they've adopted two children. And he said, friend, he said, they are my grandchildren. Now, he has to negotiate. He has to negotiate dissonance. And he's done, you know, he said, I do. My daughter knows where I stand. I don't need to say it every time. They know where we are, and our home is open. And we love our daughter, and we make the double bed up for her and her partner, and we put some flowers by the bed, and we welcome their children. But she knows where I stand. Because at the end of the day, he said, he didn't put it like this, but I really do believe that as painful as it is, and a part of me wants to see her happy, but I really do believe that it's no use making a subset of the bees happy if it dismantles the whole thing. And that's what I do believe, you see. We need to hold on to that and not be drawn into the particular at the cost of the general principles which God's given us that are so important. We're seeing the same arguments enacted over, just coming up over assisted suicide. It's the needs of the individual that trump the bigger principle, you see. Now, we're doing rather better, certainly in England, churches saying, but you can't let the needs of the individual deconstruct the principle which is good for so many people. We've got to get that argument here in the same way, you see. But our cold churches have to become places where we do negotiate that dissonance, where belief is really explicit, but we're open. And whoever you are, you know, well, how do we surrender this word inclusive? I was brought up on a hymn, whosoever will may come. I thought that was our story. And we're inclusive people. Whoever you are, we will serve you, we will welcome you. But these are our beliefs and convictions because we feel they're so good. It's not easy. Naomi. Right, Naomi, thank you. Naomi's raising a really interesting point just for the mic about how we include and accommodate people who take views over sexual morality that are quite different. And there will be a range of views in here as for how that impacts on communion. Some people would feel that taking communion is so aligned with holding biblical truth. One of our pastors shared with us his journey. In our church, it really does feel sort of normal that there are some, you know, he said, someone else, who talk about this because it's released all of us to talk about our different kinds of brokenness, our different kinds of sexual brokenness. It has been a real blessing, to be honest, to the church, because, you know, people can say, well, we're all struggling with different stuff. And that's why this the same-sex issue needs to be nested in this broader range of issues that we grapple with and that we own together, I think. It's a fascinating topic that's a big topic, and I really hope it stimulated you to get thinking, and there's more work to be done, isn't there? But thank you so much.